we think about motivation, it's less of a time issue, more of an energy issue. So you can be time rich, but if you are energy poor, you're going to waste that time. But if you're energy rich, even if you are time poor, you're going to get more done in the hours and days than many well in weeks and months. My name is Simon Alexander Ong, an international keynote speaker, award-winning coach, and the author of the best-selling book, Energize.
You started talking about the decision to leave finance. How did you discover what you want to do?
At the beginning, you're not sure if it's something you want to do long-term. So I would earn money for my job, and instead of buying the latest clothes or gadgets or toys, I would use that money to invest in seminars, to invest in books, to invest in courses. So I could learn in a very safe environment these areas that were of interest to me. I started coaching people on the side of my full-time job just to see what it was like. The way I found courage to make the decision that I felt would be most appropriate for my future were a couple of things. The first one,
how did you find your first client?
What I did is...
Can you walk us through the steps of building a brand?
When I think about brand, the first thing is, how do you engage with people? Are you someone that's approachable? The other part is then, how are you giving...
How did you build your speaker's career?
When I exited the corporate world and I set up my business, I said to myself, if I could create a successful coaching practice where I'm working with lots of one-to-one clients, I'm a happy man. But what happened is, over time, the speaking suddenly became a bigger and bigger part of what I do. For me, I was very risk averse. And so what I did is
Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on my podcast, and I'm looking forward to discuss many, many topics with you.
Likewise, looking forward to it.
Let's take it from the top. Can you talk about any pivotal moments in your early years that created you, that formed your view of the world?
There were a few pivotal moments, but I think the first one that started to change the way I saw myself and the way I saw the world was when I was 17. So I was going to school as normal. I was in physics class, and I remember the teacher came up to me and he said, "Simon, the headmaster would like to have a word with you. So if you could, can you pack your bags and go to the headmaster's office?" And I remember going down that corridor to the headmaster's office, and I was full of anxiety, because typically when you get called to the headmaster's office, often it's because you've done something wrong, or you're going to be told off, or you're going to be told to stay away from school because of something you were involved in. And so I get to the headmaster's office, I sit down, and he's looking out of the window, and he comes in front of the table, sits down himself, and he looks at me and he says, "Simon, I want you to take the rest of this week off school and however long you need." I look to my left and I see my dad sitting in the reception area of the school. And he said, "Your dad is here, your brother is in the car. Unfortunately, your mum had a tragic accident and she's at the hospital now in a coma. We don't know how she's doing, so your dad is going to take you to the hospital, and we're here if you need." And so my brother and I go into the car, my dad takes us to the hospital, and a few days later, she doesn't make it. And so the experience of going through death in that regard, especially when it's someone direct to you, your mum or your dad or a sibling, was hard. You know, this was a period of time where mental health resources and support were not freely available as it is now. And so the experience almost matured me overnight. It taught me how fragile life was, but it also changed the way I saw myself and what I saw as possible going forward. And it compelled me to take action on all of those ideas that I had in my head, because I said to myself, because life is so fragile, I have to embrace the words, "Don't wait." I have to take action today, so in time, I hopefully can make my mom proud.
Well, that's a very traumatic experience. I can't even imagine at 17 years old, how would you feel to hear something like this? So what happened after that? How did you overtake it?
So I returned to school a couple of weeks later, and I actually didn't talk about it that much. I hid it inside because I knew that if I started sharing about what had happened, I would have more questions. And I wasn't ready to answer those questions yet. I was still processing the grief and experience mentally. And it wasn't until I was at university that I began to have the courage to open up more about what had happened. So those years after the experience were very tough mentally, and it did take me a while to process it.
After this traumatic experience, you went on to create your life, right? And you decided to go into finance and banking. Why was that? Why did you choose this profession?
When I grew up, I had this mistaken belief that success was defined by my job title. My mum wanted me to be a doctor. My dad wanted me to go into engineering because he was an engineer himself. But if I were to get a job in the fields of banking, medicine, law, or accounting, and I earned good money, I would have been seen as successful. And because I saw films such as Trading Places, Boiler Room, and Wall Street, I knew a lot more about the field of finance. And it felt attractive to me at the time as a young adult because I would see the potential of making good money in there. But when I started, I quickly realized that success and fulfillment are not the same things because you can be successful in something you hate. And I began to feel this feeling of unfulfillment. And when the crisis occurred, it acted as a reason to explore what was outside of this bubble of finance. And what I did is I would spend my weekends and evenings exploring the world of business, what it would be like to work for myself, and what other areas that I would be interested in.
I see. So the financial crisis, where were you during the financial crisis? You were still working?
Yeah, so my first job was at a company called Lehman Brothers.
Oh my goodness,
which
yeah.
collapsed 14 months after I joined. So it was a very volatile period. And even when I moved to my next company, it was tough. It was a very toxic environment. In fact, it's one of the stories I draw on in the opening chapter of my book because the hours were long. I was sacrificing my health. I wasn't moving my body enough. I was surviving on junk. I wasn't getting enough sleep. And it really took a toll on my body. And I think when I went through that mode of almost being burnt out through the experience, it really showed me what was important. Did I want to live a life where I was sacrificing the present for something I wasn't really sure I wanted to do long term? Or did I want to take action today to create a future that I could be proud of?
No, absolutely. I was actually working in London, and I remember the Lehman Brothers folks on that really bad day with all their belongings walking around the city of London, Canary Wharf. Actually, I was in Canary Wharf in Citibank, and it was the same. Every day I would go to work and think, maybe this is the last day. And that was for a long period of time. But I didn't change my job at that time. I had my kids. So I decided to use this really turbulent period of time to start a family. Well, different people have different approaches, right?
Indeed, it's like events like that can force you to choose different paths and reevaluate your decisions, whether personal or professional.
You started talking about the decision to leave finance. How did you discover what you want to do?
Through the experience of working in finance, I had this temptation to work for myself. I said, as long as I work for someone else, my career path, the chance of promotion, my salary would be very much in somebody else's hands. But if I could work for myself, a lot more would be under my control. But I just didn't know what I wanted to do. So I would go outside and learn all I could from different industries. I would read books. I would go to seminars. And eventually I landed on the idea of helping people because I realized that there would be people that would always come to me, friends and family and people I'd met only recently. And I thought to myself, isn't this just being a good friend? I didn't realize that you could be compensated for helping people achieve their goals. And I decided to sign for a two-day seminar in London with a company called the Coaching Academy. And by the end of those 2 days, I said to myself, actually, there's something here. And I want to sign up and see where this goes. So I signed up and I took 3 of the qualifications they provided, and it gave me a real insight into the skill of coaching, but how I could apply that if I was to set up on my own.
Are these the steps to become a coach? So if there are people who are listening and they want to become coach, just like you or like me, so are these the steps they have to take? Can you walk us through the whole thing?
How do you become a coach? I would even take it to a bigger macro level, Annie. By what I mean is that if you put coaching to one side, I think starting any business where you work for yourself, whatever that is, it could be coaching, it could be consulting, it could be product-based, is that at the beginning, you're not sure if it's something you want to do long-term. And for me, I was very risk-averse. And so what I did is I would see the income that I made for my full-time job as almost like capital that would allow me to go and explore what I really wanted to do long-term. So I would earn money for my job, and instead of buying, I don't know, the latest clothes or gadgets or toys, I would use that money to invest in seminars, to invest in books, to invest in courses. So I could learn in a very safe environment these areas that were of interest to me. And what I began to do is once I got qualified is I started coaching people on the side of my full-time job just to see what it was like. And I think it's the same thing. If you have an idea, if you have a service that you want to share with the world, how can you start testing it at a very small scale first to see, number one, what the demand is, number two, your interest in it, do you still enjoy it once you've experienced it, and number three, is it something that you can scale? And so once you start doing that, you get the feedback, but you also get to see if you can build momentum. And if you're able to build momentum, that's a sign that maybe there's something here. And so for me, it got to this stage, Annie, where I had 3 paying clients. Balancing that with a full-time job. So I would still go to the office during the day, and I would go to the lobbies of hotels to work with my clients after work and on weekends. But it got to this point where I said to myself, if I got one more client, so if I went from 3 to 4 clients, my day job would suffer, and so would my coaching. So it really gave me this dilemma. Do I continue with my full-time job and limit myself to 3 clients outside of work and be happy with that? Or do I quit my job and I see how far I can take this? And even though I did eventually make that decision, it wasn't easy by any stretch. It took me around 5, maybe 6 months of back and forth in my head. Do I quit? Do I not quit? Do I quit? Do I not quit? Because I had a partner, there were other obligations I had to think about. We had just purchased a property. And so there were lots of things I had to consider in making that decision. And once I had it in that resignation, I eventually decided to go down the path of coaching full time. It's been an absolute roller coaster since then.
Great. You were talking that you spent 6 months back and forth thinking, should I do it or not? So talk about these emotional struggles, because a lot of people ask, so how do you decide? How do you overcome all this fear? Because you think you have a very stable job, which sometimes is not correct. It's not stable at all, but it's a paying job. And then you just, how do you make the step in and say, okay, today I'm going to leave. And you have 3 clients, but tomorrow you might have only 1, right? So how, talk about these struggles.
Yeah, the struggles are real because nobody will be able to experience what you experience when you have to make a big decision like that. Because each of us will have different obligations and constraints. But for me, the way I found courage to make the decision that I felt would be most appropriate for my future were a couple of things. The first was I started changing my environment. So what I did is I started to spend time with people who were where I wanted to be. And it allowed me to see whether their lifestyle and what they did was something I wanted to do. You know, is this something that I want to do day to day? Can I be that sort of person? And that was great because as I started to spend time with people ahead of me on this journey, not only did it show me what was possible, but it made me realize that actually this is what I want. This is the sort of lifestyle I want to create. So changing that environment, changing the energy that was around me really gave me the courage to embark into the magic of the unknown. The second thing was connecting at a deeper level to my future self. So seeing myself 20, 30 years in the future, having all the success that I wanted in all areas of my life, and really seeing who I was and what I was doing, and which decision would ultimately lead quicker to that future self becoming a reality. So connecting to that future self at a deeper level also gave me the courage to take the leap into the unknown. And third was my partner. You know, when we talk about environment, I think you cannot talk about environment without also talking about your significant other. And that is because when they tell you that I will support you and I will be with you, whatever decision you decide to make. And yes, it's going to be tough and it's not always going to be a straight line, but we will get through this together. Suddenly, you go from two individuals to moving forward, regardless of what the world throws your way, as a team. And I think when you can approach an uncertain future as a team that has each other's backs, it just gives you that sense of belief that you can take on the inevitable obstacles that you know you will face.
I completely agree with you because in my husband, I have the same support. He's my rock. And when I said I'm leaving, he said, yes, yeah, we'll make this work. So that adds so much of comfort because otherwise you're always on alert. I mean, what are they going to say? You lose a client and you say, oh, now they're going to say, well, see, you can't do it, etc. But when you have somebody supporting you and cheering you up all the time, it is that much more easier for you. I'm curious, when you started, how did you find your first clients?
What I did to find my first clients, and at this time, you know, I didn't have a website. I didn't really have social media because I knew that if my colleagues at work would find me on social media, they would say, well, are you a coach? Are you in finance? They would get confused. And so what I did is I just went to lots of networking events in London. So I would go to networking events about two or three times a week. And I would just connect with people. I would connect with people in a very human way. So I would go there and I'd be very interested about them. So I would ask them questions such as, tell me what brought you here. What are you most excited about at the moment? What are the challenges that you're facing? What are the goals that you're looking to achieve in the next year? And I would just listen. And listen and listen. And I will get more curious about their answers. So much so that often they would say to me, Simon, what do you do? I really enjoyed this powerful conversation. And I would say to them, well, if you want to go deeper, why don't we find a time to meet somewhere a bit more private so we can go a bit deeper? Maybe I can share more about how I could help you. And so I would go and meet as many people as I could to give people the experience of coaching, because I realized that if I told someone, hey, I think you could do with coaching or I can coach you, people aren't really in the mindset or state to accept it because nobody kind of goes around thinking, I've got a budget for coaching, how am I going to spend it? It doesn't occur to them that they may need a coach. But if I start to present them with what coaching could do, by giving them a mini experience for a conversation I have with them, then now they feel the impact it can have. So I just started doing that as often as I could, and I would naturally coach people in the conversations I had. And the next step was, should we continue this relationship? Should we explore this further? And that's how I started to create interest in what I do.
Great approach, actually, because you went to these people with the view to listen to them, to what they have to say, instead of pitching something. And that's so powerful. And not a lot of people understand it. But those who understand it, they really, it's a winner for them. And how does this continue? How are you finding your clients now? Is it different? Do you do the same thing?
So now I'm very fortunate. So at the beginning of the journey, it was all about outreach. You know, I have to go to events, I have to network, I have to reach out to people online, I have to go to online meetings to share who I am and what I'm about. Now I get a lot more people coming into me. So people come to me through platforms like LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook, or they see me speak on stage, or they've read my book, or they see me on a podcast, and they send me an email saying, Simon, I loved what you did, or I love following your work. I would love to see how I can get coached by you. So a lot more people come to me now compared to when I first started. And I think that just comes with time. You know, when you first start in any business, you have to do a lot of the outreach yourself at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because nobody knows who you are yet. But as you build your profile, you build your brand, you begin to add lots and lots of value in different ways, then people come across your work. And when people come across your work, they start to look at other things you're doing. And the next step is then, hey, how do I do something with you?
Yeah, you mentioned building a brand.
Mm.
Can you walk us through the steps of building a brand? Because that's another question people ask when they change careers. So how do I rebrand myself? I was in banking, for instance, and now I'm going to be an entrepreneur and I'll be in education, for instance. How do I do that? What is your advice?
For me, there's a couple of ways that we can work on our brand. And the brand is so important. And often people will say to me, Simon, what is the return on investment on building a brand? And I say, it's a hard question because you can't predict the return on investment. But just to give an example, in an example of a return on investment with brand is when people just give you opportunities. When people say, hey, Simon, I want to put your name forward to speak at this conference. That's the power of brand, because people think about you. People are happy to recommend you to their company or their client or to someone they know. But when I think about brand, the first thing is, how do you engage with people? So when you meet people for the first time, when people come to you, when people engage you on social media, how do you interact with them? Are you interacting in a way that says, hey, I want to see how I can help you. I want you to tell me what your challenges are. I want to answer some of your questions. So are you responding in a helpful way? Or are you kind of creating a bit of distance from your followers and audience? And that creates a certain perspective on who you are. Are you someone that's approachable, or are you someone that's not very approachable and I'm not sure if this person will ever read my message or mm-hmm. or email? That's one part of it. The other part is then, how are you giving value to the audience? And simply put, the quickest way to build your brand is to be someone who is valuable, someone who brings value to the public. Now, that can be through your content, writing, videos, articles, communities, groups. There's lots of different ways that you can add value to the audience. But the more you add value, the more people think, hey, this person is teaching me so much and I'm learning a lot. I want to find out more about the areas they cover and what they talk about. And so now what's happening is that way of you delivering value invites people into your ecosystem.
So you use mainly LinkedIn or Instagram? Do you have a specific strategy?
Yeah, so I'm present on all the social platforms, but the two that I use the most are Instagram and LinkedIn.
I see. This is how we met, I think.
Yeah.
You sent me something about your book, and this is how I got to know about you. And then I started following you, et cetera, et cetera. And here we are today. So this is how it happens, right? On LinkedIn or any social media platform. How did you build your speaker's career? Was this a goal?
Yeah, absolutely not. So when I first started, when I exited the corporate world and I set up my business, I said to myself, if I could create a successful coaching practice where I'm working with lots of one-to-one clients, I'm a happy man. But what happened is over time, the speaking suddenly became a bigger and bigger part of what I do. When I first started speaking, it was purely to market my coaching. So I would speak to an audience to talk about my coaching work and my thoughts and my insights and lessons, and that would draw people into my coaching. But then people started asking me how much I charged. And then people wanted to pay for my speaking. And I thought, well, this is an interesting path to take. And then I spoke at more companies and conferences. And now speaking is probably a bigger part of what I do than the coaching is.
I see. What about self-promotion and marketing? For somebody like you, a coach and a speaker, what does this mean?
Acting as a marketer and a PR person to your own business is such an important skill, because half of the game is being good at what you do. So you can be a really good coach, you can have a really solid product or service, but that's only half the game. If you don't know how to communicate the value of what you can offer, which is the marketing, the PR, and the branding, well, the business isn't really going to grow. And so with a lot of the things I do, I'm always thinking about how I share what I'm doing from a marketer's perspective. So, you know, when I was going through the journey of publishing my book, I wanted to share the stories behind it, you know, recording the audiobook, seeing my book being printed for the first time. And so I was inviting people to follow the book journey through what I was sharing in my content. And because of that, you end up creating this intimate relationship with the audience. And I think that's essential. You know, you've got to think about ways to get people's attention, to say, hey, look at this. I think you should read this. I think you should buy this. I think you should check this out. And that's key, because attention is crucial in a world in which our attention spans are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. And there's just so much information on people's phones. You know, how do you get onto someone's radar amongst an ocean of other things that are vying for their attention?
Absolutely. And talking about your book, tell me more about it. When did you have the idea? What triggered the desire to write a book? I always wondered, what triggers a desire to write a book in somebody?
Sure. So I always have lots of things that I want to do. Writing a book was one of them, but it was never sort of top of my priority list until I got an offer from a boutique publisher. And when I got the offer, which I declined actually, because it didn't feel like a great offer, it got me thinking about maybe this is a sign from the universe that I'm meant to write a book. And so that got me to the mood of reaching out to publishing houses, building relationships with those in the publishing industry, first to understand the mechanics of what went into the book writing process, but also to increase the chances that when I was ready, I could send a message to them, because they were now following my content to say, hey, I've got an idea for a book, what do you think? And so that's what I did. And Penguin very fortunately got back to me in January 2020 and said, hey, do you want to come to our offices and have a discussion about your ideas? And a couple of weeks later, I was putting together a book proposal to send to them. And before long, we were then signing a contract to write Energize.
And why Energize? Why talking about energy? I mean, that's what I'm very interested in.
Yeah, I think what I noticed when I looked at my journey, the clients I worked with and the audiences I spoke to, is I noticed that energy is the currency of motivation. I noticed that energy is the currency of motivation, because when we think about motivation, and we all want more of it. You know, people always say, I don't feel motivated to do something. I need more motivation to achieve my goals. When we think about motivation, it's less of a time issue, more of an energy issue. So you can be time rich, but if you are energy poor, you're going to waste that time. You're going to procrastinate. You're going to delay things. You're just going to not make effective use of the time you have. But if you're energy rich, even if you are time poor, you're going to get more done in the hours and days than many well in weeks and months. And so I really wanted to speak to that. I really wanted to speak to the fact that we can, by better managing our energy, not only become more motivated, but accomplish a hell of a lot more. And so the thesis was that energy management, not time management, is the key to productivity. And when you address the four dimensions of energy, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, what happens is that you begin fulfilling your potential.
How do you structure something like this? How do you, for people who are listening and want to build, write a book, what are the steps? Can you just share? What do you go through? What is the creative process?
Well, I would like to say that there is a lot of structure, but the process for me in writing the book was a very challenging one, because when I got close to getting the offer from Penguin, I imagined to myself, how would I go about writing the book? I would have my desk in front of me. I would have a nice cup of tea. I would sketch out the ideas. I would look to do research and then pull all these things together. And we were expecting our first child. And I thought that if our family would come over, they could help with childcare. And I could focus on the book writing. And things would be great. So that was my idea I had in my head. The reality was, as I got the book deal, COVID happened. So the pandemic happened and both sides of our family had to cancel their tickets. They could not come to be at the birth of our daughter. And it meant that we had no help in those first few weeks of birth. My wife had a C-section, so it meant she was out of action for 6 to 8 weeks. And we couldn't go outside and nobody could come in and everything was shut.
Gosh.
And my speaking, which at the time was a big part of what I do, all my bookings for speaking went to zero. And so I had to also adapt my business to take on more coaching in order to balance the fact that there, at least for the first few months, was no speaking events because everybody was worried. How do we pivot our business to a remote-only workforce? And the writing process was anything but structured because I would sit down, I would write for 20 minutes, and then our daughter would cry and I had to go and change her nappy. And I would come back, I would continue writing for another 40 minutes, and then she would need to be put to bed. And so I'm back in the room doing, you know, parent stuff.
Yeah.
And so it was very unstructured in that way. And I would come back and I would try and remember where I was at in the process.
Yeah.
But if I look at it in terms of how I tackled it, in terms of the different steps, I think the very first place was structuring the narrative of the book in the same way that I structure a presentation. So if you are, let's say, for example, you've been invited to do a TED Talk. When you do a TED Talk, you begin with the end in mind. What is the message that you want to leave the audience with? And then you work backwards. How are you going to begin? What are the stories that you want to touch on in the middle of your presentation? And so I followed a very similar setup in writing the book. I said to myself, well, what's the message I want the audience to take away by the time they get to that last chapter? How do I want to open the book so I get their attention and I start to explain the concepts I'm going to dive into? And what are the stories that I want to have in the middle? Because once you know the stories and what you want to share in the middle, you can begin to give the middle of the book some structure. Are there themes or parts that I can split this into so there's a bit of order in how I present them? So that's how I started. And once I had this journey mapped out, I then said, okay, now I've got to go and do some research. I want to pull in case studies or quotes or stories. And then I lay those out. And then it's like a jigsaw then, because then you're piecing the puzzle together. You're thinking of what is the thread that goes between these messages and stories that can bring this nicely into one narrative. So that's how I started the journey.
Interesting. It was turbulent, I guess, juggling all these things. I have twins, so I also had C-section. I can't imagine how I would write a book having the children, etc. You're a hero.
It's tough, and I think there were so many heroic acts during those years of the pandemic, and that's why when the book was published, it was so sweet to see people taking photos and videos of the book on social media, because it's just so nice to see it out in the world.
And what is that one thing that people should take out? The thing that you started your book process with, what is it?
Sure. So I would say, if I could share one thought from the book about what it would teach you when you read it, is that when you become a better CEO, now when I say CEO, what I mean is chief energy officer. When you become a better chief energy officer, what happens is you transform your life and your career. You wake up with the feeling that there is so much possible that you can achieve, and you start to tap into that energetic potential that we all have inside of us. And when that happens, not only you, but everyone that comes into your path will feel it. They will notice something has changed, and you will step into who you were meant to be.
Well, this is powerful. Thank you. You are at this stage of your life, looking back at the decision you made through the years, how do you feel about them?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad I made that decision. I'm so glad I made the decision to embark on this path. At the same time, I think some of the things I thought about the path before I stepped on the path have turned out to be true. You know, I knew this was going to be a challenging journey. I knew this was not going to be easy. I knew that there would be lots and lots of obstacles, and that is true now. Regardless of that, I still think I made the right decision because I think I'm going through the best education I've ever had. You know, I've done school, I've done college, I've done university, I've been in the corporate world, but nothing beats the education you get when you run your own business, because you have to learn so much on the job, and you have to put it into action almost immediately to see the value of that idea. And that really accelerates your learning.
Absolutely. I mean, being an entrepreneur for the last 18 months, I learned so much, because you're everything. You're the advertiser, the accountant, the presentation writer, everything. You do every single job and you become very good at it. And again, looking back at your journey, what would be the advice you give to your younger self?
Looking back, I think the advice I would give my younger self is listen to your heart over the opinions of others. It may not always take you to where you want to be, but it will always take you to where you need to be. And that speaks to the fact that we all have inner wisdom. We all are born with this wisdom inside of us. You can call it your gut or your intuition, whatever it is. But it always speaks to us. But so often we suppress that voice in order to validate ourselves by pleasing other people. But the moment we listen to our heart and we take action based on what it is saying to us, that's when life becomes truly magical. And it is also why there is a saying that goes, the longest journey that we humans make are the inches from our heads to our hearts.
Absolutely powerful. Again, I can understand why people want to work with you and want to be coached by you. Absolutely. You have a way to make people want to talk to you and be around you. So thank you very much for this discussion. And I wish you absolutely all the best.
Thank you so much for having me on, Annie.
This is all for today. Thank you for being with me till the end. And before you go, I have a huge favor to ask. Would you please subscribe or leave a message and send us any comments and recommendations? The more we hear from you, the better this podcast will be. Thank you for now and see you in the next episode.